Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Tonight, my guest is Peter Muse. Before I bring him on, I'm going to remind you that you can always get new regular episodes free on Rockfin, Odyssey, and all podcast platforms. But if you go to Rockfin and you get a premium account, you're going to get all the content you can't get anywhere else, and you can get our regular shows, and you get all the premium content from every creator there on Rockfin. You can also get a free account just to check out what's there, and there is tons of free content there as well. Also, check out the new podcasts from the Forbidden Knowledge Network, such as Inception, Raised by Giants, Day Zero, Dawson Time, and of course, Forbidden Knowledge News and Beyond Classified. You can get them all in one place, our website, forbiddenknowledge.news. Also, if you would like your show featured on the Forbidden Knowledge Network, just email me, forbiddenknowledgenews@gmail.com, and we can get that set up for you guys. Tonight, I want to welcome Peter Muse. With degrees in anthropology, he has been exploring New England legends, folklore, and weird traditions for 20 years. He has been blogging at New England Folklore since 2008, and he is the author of Legends and Lore of the North Shore. He has also appeared as a guest expert on the Travel Channel's Mysteries at the Museum. Peter, welcome. How are you doing tonight?
Good. Excited to be here. Very excited to be here tonight. Looking forward to talking about lots of weird and spooky things with you.
Definitely. I am actually very excited to do this, too. This is one of my favorite topics. We're going to discuss your book, Witches and Warlocks of Massachusetts. It not only covers the trial accounts and witch narratives from the 1600s, but also legends and folk stories from the 1700s and 1800s from across Massachusetts, urban legends and paranormal stories from the 20th and 21st century, and the Salem witch trials, with 70 additional witch legends and historical accounts from other cities and towns across Massachusetts. So this is going to be awesome. We got all kinds of stuff we can talk about. But this is your first time on the show. Let's hear about what got you started down this path.
Sure. I grew up in the 1970s. I was a kid in the 70s. And, you know, in the 70s, sort of the paranormal and the occult really started to become popular topics in the mainstream media, right? Like Bigfoot was a big deal, UFOs, the Bermuda Triangle, right? All of that sort of stuff. Reincarnation, just all sorts of unusual topics kind of bubbled up from the 60s counterculture and became mainstream in the 70s. And so that was just like on TV, it was in the media and things like that, like Bigfoot sightings were happening. They'd be showing up in the local papers at that time, you know what I mean, in Massachusetts. And plus I have an older brother who he's 3 years older than me. So he was kind of into that stuff even more than me. So he had lots of books about UFOs. He had books about various unexplained mysteries and things like that. So I just sort of absorbed a lot of that paranormal stuff. So that's like one stream, right? That kind of paranormal sort of countercultural stuff. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I was always one of those kids who was really interested in like mythology and folklore. Like I had books about Greek mythology, Norse mythology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, Arabian Nights, all those books. And so, you know, I went to college, I got a couple degrees in anthropology. And again, I was interested in like the lore, the folklore, the legends, the mythology. And then really it was only when I got out of college that I realized I didn't know so much about the folklore and legends of the place I've lived my whole life. I've lived in Massachusetts my whole life, except for spending time in Maine. So really I spent my whole life in the New England area. And so I was like, oh, I don't know that much about like the mythology, the folklore of this place I've lived forever. So I just started to study that and research that, and then I've never stopped. So it's been going on for at least, I don't know, 25 years or something like that. So it's been good. Like I met a lot of interesting people, and the more I learn about like the folklore from this area, the more I find there is to know. It feels like it's a bottomless, endless.
Yeah, I think once you enter into this paranormal field, like it gets pretty deep, and the more I learn, the less I know as well. You know, I feel the exact same way. Now, you said, you know, growing up in this area and you never really researched the lore behind it. Have you had any strange or paranormal experiences growing up in that area?
You know, the only one I would really say was super strange was, well, a couple, right? One, I'll tell you the one that sticks out the most. When I was probably like 5 or 6, I was a real little kid. My brother, myself, and our backyard neighbor, this guy named Wayne, we were just out playing in the backyard. It was summertime, and this bright, bright light came down in the sky, right? Like descended from the sky down behind a hill, and we all just freaked out, right? And my brother, who of course was like a UFO person, like, oh my God, it's a UFO. We've seen a UFO. And maybe it was, I don't know what, a flare, maybe it was a helicopter, but we were like amazed and also terrified. Like, I remember we saw it and then we ran in the house like, Ma, Dad, we saw a UFO, right? And our friends' parents weren't home, so we had to stay with us till his parents came home because it was like this weird. And it was like, I remember that sense of amazement and also terror. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that kind of like sticks in my brain. The other thing is like kind of related to the book, which is in Warlocks of Massachusetts. When I was a kid, there was an older woman who lived up the street from us. And she lived in like this rundown house, like the grass was like 3 feet high in front of her house. She always had the shades down. She had a million cats. And I just remember walking by her house and I was being a little spooked, like, cause she was so unusual. And I remember somebody said to me, I don't know if it was another kid or if it was an adult on the street. They're like, oh yeah, that lady, I think she could be a witch, right? Maybe they were only joking, but I was spooked when I was a kid, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then later that same woman with all the cats in the unusual house, got a dog. She got this big black dog that had no hair on its back. And that just like put me over the edge. I'm like, yeah, I'm crossing the street. I'm not walking by that house anymore. And,
right.
You know, this was like the 1970s, but I still, like in retrospect, I remember that feeling and also realize now that I was like part of this long kind of cultural tradition of like thinking eccentric people are witches, right? Erroneously. For the most part, but thinking like, oh, that she's unusual. She's a little outside the norm. Therefore, she must be a witch or something like that. You know, I was like 8 years old. I can be forgiven for that, I think. But
it's very interesting. And when you know, the more you learn about it, the more you come to have an understanding about this stuff. But when it comes to your book and the witch narratives from the 1600s, where did the kind of witch madness start in the Salem trials begin? Do you have any earliest accounts?
Yeah, it's interesting. The so this part of Massachusetts, New England overall, was settled by Europeans really early on. So, you know, the Pilgrims landed in Plymouth 1620. Salem is settled in 1626. Like Boston's founded 1630. So it's old. So those folks really could have, put in perspective, like they could have seen Shakespeare's plays performed live on stage for the very first time, right? It's a totally different worldview. It's like a Renaissance worldview. It's not like a modern worldview like people would have had in the American Revolution. So they came over really early on. Plus they came from a part of England called East Anglia. East Anglia is where the biggest witch hunts in England took place. And so it only makes sense that they kind of came from the place where they had these really strong witch beliefs, came over to New England, and then this is where the big witch trials happened here, because they just brought those witch beliefs with them. And not that there weren't witch beliefs across the United States, because there were, right? All sorts of cultures have witch beliefs. But I think it was like the timing they came over and where they came from. And really, you know, 1641, the Puritans in Boston passed a law that condemned anyone who was found guilty of witchcraft to death. So that was 1641. They'd only been here 11 years. Like, all right, we need a law against witchcraft. And then by 1648, the first person was executed for witchcraft in Boston. It was a woman named Margaret Jones. She was an herbal healer, right? So she would treat people with plants and try to cure their ailments. And she was super successful. Like people like, oh yeah, Margaret Jones, she really has it down. She is curing us with these really simple plants. But after a certain point, people were like, how can she be so effective at her cures when she's using such simple ingredients? Like, is there something else going on here?
Mm-hmm.
And so people actually got suspicious that she was too effective at what she did, and eventually accused her of being a witch, and she was executed. Her husband was also accused of being a witch, but he was not executed. He escaped from Massachusetts and fled to another colony somewhere else. So she was the first person executed here.
Now, did you see any other nefarious agendas behind the witch trials besides just, you know, misunderstandings or not understanding what this person is doing or their belief system or things of that nature?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, if you look at the statistics for the people who were executed, it tended to be before the Salem trials, there were 5 women executed in Massachusetts for witchcraft over a span of 50 years. So they were all women, right? And often I think it was women who kind of transgressed some of those social norms, right? There was a woman named Alice Lake from Dorchester, Massachusetts, just south of Boston. And like she had premarital sex. And then after she had premarital sex, she tried to abort her baby and she failed at that, right? And then she married the man who had impregnated her and they were raising the child. But I think when she was accused of witchcraft, people remembered those other things like, oh yeah, she had premarital sex. She was a fornicator, like that was the word, fornicator. And then her husband, you know, she had tried to abort her baby. And so for the Puritans, like those, from those things, it's just a short step to witchcraft. Like if you're already sinning, like you're gonna be, might as well be a witch. There was also a very wealthy woman in Boston named Anne Hibbins, who was super argumentative, right? She just was an argumentative person. Her church actually excommunicated her because she was so argumentative, which is very, like women were not supposed to be argumentative at the time. When her husband died, she was quickly accused of witchcraft and executed. So you often see women, I think, who were outside the social norm being accused of witchcraft and executed for it, versus men who were also accused of witchcraft, but generally weren't executed as much. Even in the Salem trials, it's like 14 women are executed and 5 men, and plus one man is crushed to death during torture. So,
do you think that during this time period is when kind of the view of women in general started to shift and, you know, the control of men became, I guess, more dominant as far as putting forth rules from religion and doctrine and things of that nature?
Well, you know, the Puritans were really strict, right? They were pretty strict people. They came to North America to really set up a theocratic state, right? Everyone should be a Puritan. If you weren't a Puritan, let's say you lived, you know, in Salem, Massachusetts in 1680, right before the witch trials, like you would be expected to pay the Puritan minister's salary, even if you were not a Puritan, right? Even if they didn't allow you to go to that church, you still had to contribute taxes to pay the Puritan minister's salary. So it was very focused on like religion and strict moral codes of behavior. So I do think compared to maybe some other, you know, religions and other cultures, certainly they were much stricter, you know. They were also, I mean, men also had strict moral codes too, but men just were not executed as much. Some people have speculated that they thought women were more susceptible to temptation, right? Like they thought back like to the Bible where Eve is tempted by the devil and then Eve tempts Adam, right? So therefore, maybe that's more likely why women would be likely to be witches. Right? They're more easily tempted by the devil, but I don't think that's the case.
Do you think there was actual real witchcraft that, you know, some could be considered, I guess, satanic witchcraft or something more nefarious that was going on along those times that actually was in the mix with the women that they were putting on trial?
Yeah, like you hear that sometimes, right? Like some people have speculated that. I know there've been some TV shows that had that, like the show Salem, right? It said like, right, ooh, there are real witches and they're letting the fake witches be executed, but the real witches are behind it all. I don't think there were, right? I don't think there were any real witches, but there were plenty of people at the time who practiced magic. So there were a lot of like, the Puritan clergy were like, no, magic is bad, don't practice any magic. Everyone below the Puritan clergy is like, you know, I'm sending my ship out on a sea voyage. I'm going to talk to an astrologer. You know, I want to know who I'm going to get married. I'm going to go to a palm reader. People had books about astrology. People had books about magic. And so magic was being practiced by lots of people in New England at that time. And a couple of the people who were executed during Salem actually did practice magic. There was a man named Samuel Wardwell, who was just, he was just a farmer, but he also made extra money as a fortune teller. And people said that he was super accurate, right? And so when it came time for the Salem trials, people were like, boy, he's really accurate. Like, how does he know these things? He's just looking at my palm, but he knows who I'm going to marry or whatever. So he was, you know, tried and executed. And I guess that's a trend, right? If you're too good at what you do, they're being executed. They're too good at being a healer, too good at being a fortune teller, you're going to get in trouble. So also a lot of magic that people practice was actually magic against witches. So, you're probably familiar with like a horseshoe, right? You hang a horseshoe up over a door. People say that's for good luck, you know, with the points up. 400 years ago, that was to keep witches out of your house. And, you know, people nail the doors, the horseshoes up over their houses to keep the witches from entering. And there are even some stories from, you know, 1800s later of people in Massachusetts just covering their houses with horseshoes to keep witches away from the house entirely. And sort of the grossest form of magic that you might encounter when you read about this stuff is something called a witch bottle. I don't know if you know what a witch bottle is. Let's say you were bewitched, right? We think you're bewitched. Like, oh, you're a witch is attacking you. You're writhing. You're speaking in tongues, whatever. Like, okay. So we take some of your urine and we put it in a bottle or a jar, whatever we have. And then we throw in nails. We throw in pins, maybe we throw in broken glass, like whatever we have that is sharp and painful, okay? And the idea is that the witch, wherever they are, they have made a connection to you to practice, to harm you with their magic, right? That connection is connected to all parts of your body. So it's connected to your hair, your fingernails, and your urine, your body, whatever. So we can't stick nails into you because that would be bad, right? Instead, we can stick the nails in your urine. And so that's going to send pain back along this connection to the witch who's causing the harm to you. And it's supposed to like make the witch stop hurting you, okay?
Right.
In extreme cases, they would take that bottle full of urine, nails, pins, whatever, and they would put it in a fire even and heat it up till it exploded. So that would be like supposed to send so much pain back to the witch. Also, that would cause a big mess. Like, don't try that at home.
When it comes to the other stories from your book, legend folk stories, let's say from the 1700s and 1800s, many of these were based on real people. Isn't that right?
It's true. Yeah, they are based on real people, and then they sort of become legendary over time, you know.
What were some of the most, maybe you could give us a few of the most profound stories, some of the cliff notes from the book.
Sure. You know, this is like a classic witch story, right? Classic witch story. Gloucester, Massachusetts is a fishing community up on Cape Ann, north of here. And a woman lived in that town named Peg Wesson. And everybody thinks that Peg is a witch, right? Peg is a witch, Peg is a witch, Peg Wesson's a witch. And so this is like the 1760s, I think it is. A bunch of soldiers are leaving Gloucester. They're going to go fight up in Canada against the French. And so they're hanging out in Gloucester, getting drunk, and they see Peg Wesson in the street. And so these young soldiers are feeling brave. They're like, ah, Peg Wesson, you old witch. You know, they spit at her, whatever. And Peg Wesson's like, you are going to be sorry you spit at me. I'm going to get you, right? And then she stalks off. And they just laugh because they're young and they're drunk or whatever. The next week or 2 weeks later, they're up in Canada, stationed outside this fortress, and they're trying to attack the fortress, and they're kind of like hunkered down behind bushes and trees and like that. And the French are in the fortress shooting at these soldiers from Gloucester. So, and you know, the Gloucester guys really have to stay low because otherwise they can get hit by like a cannonball or rifle shot or whatever. So they hunker down low, and suddenly up in the sky above them, this gigantic black crow appears. And it kind of dives down at the Gloucester soldiers and starts pecking at them. They try to shoo it off, and it flies back up, and then it comes back down and is just like attacking them and clawing at them. And they even shoot at it with their rifles. But nothing seems to hurt it, right? They hit it dead on with a bullet. It just nothing hurts. It keeps attacking them. And they realize that the crow is trying to get them to stand up and run. And if they stand up and run, they're going to be shot by the French. And so finally, one of the guys from Gloucester, one of the soldiers, thinks, oh, you know what? This crow is probably the spirit of Peg Wesson that she sent to attack us, right? To try to kill us because we abused her. And you can only hurt a witch, he thinks, by using silver. So he takes a silver button off his coat, puts it in his rifle and shoots it up at the crow, hits the crow in the leg. The crow gives this like hideous squawk and just vanishes, okay? That very day, supposedly, in Gloucester, Peg Wesson goes to a doctor and she's limping. And she says, oh, doctor, I fell down the stairs. I hurt my leg. And so when the doctor kind of pulls down her stocking and pulls up her skirt to look at her leg, he notices a bloody wound. And when he digs in the bloody wound, he of course pulls out a silver button. So that's sort of a classic like 19th century witch story, right?
Wow.
Like the witch is out there causing harm and how do you stop them? And there's always like this little bit of proof, like, and that's how you knew that this person was a witch, right? You find the silver button in them or something like that.
And a lot of these stories, the witches are more of like this kind of ghostly spiritual type entity, right? And not necessarily a physical person.
Well, it's interesting. Like when you read like recent stories, like I think in the 20th, 21st century, there are still witch legends being told in Massachusetts, right? A lot of them are more like paranormal accounts. And usually they will involve like a witch that's a ghost of some kind, right? Or it's like the victim of a witch hunt is now haunting this area. Like there's a place in North Andover, Massachusetts called Albino Road, which is like this little dirt road kind of in a rural suburban area in the woods. There's a big like metal do not enter sign across that road. Like do not go down Albino Road. I've been to Albino Road, but I did not go there during the night. I will tell you, I went during the day. And so the legend about Albino Road is that, you know, in the 1600s, a Puritan family lived there, a man and a wife, and they had two boys. They had these twin sons. And the twin sons were really pale. They had white hair. They had pale white skin. They had pinkish eyes. They were albino, right? And so their parents knew that this was, you know, there's nothing wrong with this, but they thought that their Puritan neighbors who were super intolerant would think there was something unusual or monstrous about these two boys. So they told their boys, like, whatever you do, don't show yourself to anybody. And so they raised these two boys for like 12, 13 years, whatever, in total isolation. And whenever neighbors came, they would hide the boys. Like, boys, you have to hide and neighbors coming over. Till finally, at one point, like the boys are like 14 at this point. The parents go into town to do some errands. And the boys are out in the yard doing whatever. And a neighbor shows up unannounced at the farm. And this neighbor sees these two boys like, holy crap, look at those two unusual looking people. I think they might be demons. So he gets the constable arrests the two boys and brings them into town. And all the elders of the town, the Puritan, the ministers, the constables are like, what are we gonna do? Like, we think these two boys, since they're unusual looking, could be demons. So they devise this test. They wrap the boys in chains and they decide to throw them in a pond. And they say, you know what? If the boys float, that means they're human. But if the boys sink, that means they're demons. And of course, since the boys are wrapped in chains, they sink and then they drown. And then the Puritan ministers and the constables are like, well, you know, might as well burn down that family's house while we're at it. So they go, they burn down the family's house. And this is sort of the end of the story, except of course, like now Albino Road is supposedly haunted by the ghosts of the two boys who were drowned in the pond. So if you go there at night, you can see these pale figures with these red glowing eyes kind of walking through the woods or walking on the road there. And of course, like, you don't want to be there at night and encounter them because they don't like strangers to coming in there, right? They learn their lesson, like no strangers on the farm, like keep out.
Yeah.
So you get a lot of stories like that, right? Like maybe there's a ghost out there. There's also, I don't know if you know who Giles Corey is. He was...
Yes, I've heard of
him. Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in case your audience doesn't know, he was a farmer in Salem. He was an older guy. He was like 81 years old. He was accused of being a witch. when he was put on trial, he went up on the stand and the judge said, "Oh, Giles Corey, how do you plead, innocent or guilty?" And he didn't say anything. And that was his like legal tactic. Like he was not going to speak a word. So no matter what they asked him on the stand, he refused to speak. And so according to Massachusetts law at that time, if someone didn't speak when they were put on trial, they could be pressed under heavy weights to get them to speak. So the sheriff drags Giles Corey out to a field. They tie him down to the ground, like, you know, stake him down, put a board on his chest, and they start to pile big rocks on top of him. They put these rocks on top of him, and they say, you know, "Giles Corey, do you have anything to say?" He is totally mute. They put more rocks on top of Giles Corey. "Giles Corey, do you have anything to say?" He refuses to say anything. And they can hear his ribs starting to crack, right, at this point, because there's so much weight. They put even more weight on him. And, you know, they can hear the bones breaking. They say, "Giles Corey, do you have anything to say?" And the only thing he says is, "More weight." And so they put even more stones on top of him and he dies. So kind of, it's a well-known story.
Yeah. Yeah, that
his
is.
His ghost supposedly haunts the place where he died, which coincidentally is now a cemetery. Like he wasn't buried at that cemetery. At the time he was killed there, it was just an open field, but it's now a cemetery in Salem. So supposedly people who go to that cemetery have seen like a man in sort of older colonial era clothing wandering around that cemetery. And supposedly his ghost also has appeared in Salem at times when it is supposed to face a disaster. Like there's a big fire in Salem. I want to say like 1919, something like that, maybe a little earlier, that destroyed like hundreds and hundreds of buildings. Before that happened, like people saw his ghost walking the street. Like, why are we seeing Giles Corey's ghost walking the street? And then like, 2 days later, half the town burns down, you know? So he's like an omen of bad things happening.
Do you think a lot of this activity that occurs around this area is because of the so much trauma in the past that's surrounding, so much energy that has been brought out through these, you know, strange and traumatic events that have happened in the past?
Yeah, I've heard that theory. Like there are a bunch of different theories why. Like why is New England weirder maybe than some other places? If it is, I don't know. Like, but I would say like it's when you look at the three like major horror writers that in American history, right? You've got like Edgar Allan Poe, who was born in Boston, grew up in Boston, lived in Boston until he was a youngish man. Then he's like, "I can't take it anymore. These people are so uptight, I'm leaving." So he was one. Then you have H.P. Lovecraft, right, who was from Rhode Island, right, in the really popular in the 20s and 30s. That was when he was most productive. And then you have Stephen King. So you have these three big, like, horror writers, and all from this tiny part of the country. Like, America is a huge place. They're from this one tiny part of it. And so I feel like there is something here that gives rise to that. Like, why do we produce these great horror writers and these great horror stories? And what it is hard to say. Like, is it because we, like I said earlier, like the Puritans came over so long ago and they brought like those medieval Renaissance type of beliefs with them, right? Is it that there has been just many, many more years of trauma? And if you believe that in sort of residual psychic energy, is that what's causing it, right?
Right.
And some people do think that there's something in the psychic imprint here. And I even like part, sometimes I think, is it just the landscape? Like it's a weird landscape, like giant random boulders, you know, mountains, cliffs, beaches. It's a weird mix of everything here.
Right.
So I don't know. Yeah. It's interesting though, right? Like why so much weirdness here?
Yeah, it makes you wonder about other, you know, places of high strangeness as well, like Skinwalker Ranch, Sedona, Arizona, Mount Shasta, like these just strange places that attract weird energy. Even Pennsylvania, I've heard, has, you know, a lot of strange stuff going on in it. But not only is there, you know, a lot of witch and paranormal lore, but there is fairy folklore from New England as well, right?
It's true. Yeah, there is. It's, I don't know if you've heard the term puckwudgie, right? People talk about puckwudgies around here.
I have heard that, yeah.
Yeah, right? So there's sort of these small, they are said to be, I've never met one myself, so people say that puckwudgies are these small, hairy humanoids, right? Like maybe 3 feet high, covered with long hair. Some descriptions of them give them almost like a dog-like snout or something. And live in the woods, cause trouble, right? There's a place in Freetown, Massachusetts, which is down south of Boston, where they say the Pukwudgies are particularly prevalent, the Freetown State Forest. People have said there's even a cliff there where Pukwudgies have been known to like give people just a little...
Is this like a Native American type of legend?
It's a mix. When the Puritans came here, like they said, oh, there were no fairies here, because they only were concerned with witches, ghosts, and the devil, right? They didn't think about fairies. That was not really from the part of the country they were from. They were like, witches, ghosts, devil, no fairies here. That's it.
Right.
They were ignoring like the Native Americans who had like these vast trove of legends about various like magical creatures that live in the woods, right? Some small, yeah. Some big, some benevolent, some malevolent, whatever. They were ignoring all that. Really, like in the 1900s, this poet Longfellow wrote A Song of Hiawatha, famous poem, and he talks about Pukwudgies in that poem. Pukwudgies are really from the Midwest, like from the Ojibwe nation, right? They talk about Pukwudgies there. But Longfellow's poem was really popular, and somehow the term Pukwudgie became prevalent here in this part of the country as well. And so now often when people talk about the local fairies here, they will call them Pukwudgie. So it's kind of a mix of like Native American lore, but the name comes from another part of the country. And then people, I think, of all ethnicities now talk about Pukwudgies and have contributed to the lore. So they're a mix. It's a mix of things. And what actually happens when you encounter Pukwudgie, I'm not exactly sure. Like, there's some YouTube videos of people having almost like a possession experience when they encounter Pukwudgie, but the earlier legends don't talk about that. So I don't know. I also feel like your mindset and your culture kind of determines how you experience some of these things, right? If you go into the woods thinking you're going to encounter something scary and malevolent, you'll probably encounter something scary and malevolent. Where if you're kind of like, maybe it's neutral or maybe it's actually good, you might encounter something that's neutral or good.
Yeah, I believe that.
But that's my vibe, right? That's my vibe.
Yeah, it kind of goes along with this whole creating your reality and manifesting what you're kind of putting out there. But that could be a whole nother show altogether.
Right.
Is there any more modern accounts of these Pukwudgies or fairies or anything that you've heard?
Sure. Yeah. Like, there are videos on YouTube of people in Massachusetts like encountering the Pukwudgie. And seeing that, I had somebody write to me who actually was of Native descent, and they actually lived in a big city, Lawrence, Massachusetts, which is a pretty big city in Massachusetts. And when this person was young, they were staying with their grandparents, who are also of Native descent. And, you know, they noticed things would happen around their grandparents' house. Like their grandparents would leave out food and say, oh, we're just leaving that out for like the cat or something like that. And, but it wouldn't be cat food. It'd be like a plate of like human food. And then the human food would just disappear, right? The plate would be empty. Grandparents like, oh, I guess the cat ate it. You know, little things like that. And so one day this young person, a young woman, was sitting on the couch in her grandparents' house, and she feels something tug on her hair. She's watching TV and she feels like something tug on her hair, like, oh, ow, ow, like something. So she turns around and looks, and standing behind the couch is this little like 3 foot tall person with really long hair, like down to their feet, just pulling on her hair. And she screams, and then the creature just runs off. And she tells her grandparents just laugh like, oh yeah, no, you're just seeing things. There's nothing here, right? There's nothing here. And then like a month later, this young girl movies with some friends. She sees the movie and she's staying at her grandparents. She goes back to her grandparents' house and their car is out of the driveway. So the grandparents are not there. And as she opens the door to go in the house, she goes in the living room and she sees again these two small people with long, long hair run off into like the corners and disappear. And so she sort of, by this point, realizes that her grandparents have this relationship with these small magical people, right? These Pukwudgies or whatever you want to call them, like they would have different names in different native languages from the area. But, and so they were not malevolent in this case. They were actually, you know, a positive or neutral thing in the house. They were just a little unusual if you weren't used to them.
That's interesting. I find the more I'm learning about all these different types of phenomenon, the closer connections become, and the more information we get, there's more of like this crossover between paranormal phenomenon and aliens and UFOs and, you know, shadow people could be interdimensionals. It's all, they all seem to have some kind of strange crossover or connection in some way. Have you seen this as well in your research?
Oh, sure. I think, like what I feel, and I, you know, often I'm skeptical, right? Particularly when during the daytime and the lights are on, I'm like, I don't believe in any of this. Maybe if you put me out in the woods at night and we're like, maybe there's some truth to this, right? Put me in a cemetery at night and be like, yeah, definitely there's some truth to this. But I think people have always experienced strange things. I think people always experience strange things. And how we try to explain it is what shifts over time. So I know, for example, like you look back to some of these witch stories from like 1660, I know this one. There was a woman named Elizabeth Morse. She lived in Newbury, Massachusetts. And her house had lots of strange phenomena happening. Like rocks were being thrown. Nobody could see where the rocks came from. Pots and pans would fall off the walls. Someone, you know, an invisible hand throws a shoe at her head. Doors are slamming shut, right? And like like a paranormal investigator now would say, oh, that sounds like you have a poltergeist. Like that sounds like there's a poltergeist in your house. But back then, so there's a witch, like a witch is right. attacking her house, right? Yeah. That's a witch versus a poltergeist. And there was another case from 1843. So more recent in Pepperell, Massachusetts, this guy named Absalom Lawrence. Same thing happened in his house where at first he thought it was a ghost where they would hear like moaning sounds coming from in the house. Pots and pans were rattling, drawers were opening, right? They would hear footsteps, but there was nobody there. And he's like, oh, maybe, you know, our house is haunted. But then his daughter, who's like 14 or 15, started to have all these strange symptoms, like her body's contorted in uncomfortable positions. Her tongue protrudes out of her mouth and she can't speak. Her jaw locks. Maybe she's barking like a dog. Like all these things are happening. And we might say, oh, maybe that's demonic possession. But he's like, you know what? It's a witch. Like a witch has not only ruined my house, he's attacking my daughter. And so he actually, since it's 1843, he hired a hypnotist to come in because they had sort of like wandering hypnotists at the time. This hypnotist came with their assistant and he puts the assistant into a hypnotic trance. And in the trance, the assistant says, oh, you know, I can see an old woman. She comes here on a horse that has no horseshoes on it. And then she creeps in through the keyhole or she creeps in under the door. And she's causing the trouble in this house and she's a witch. And we will expel her using our hypnotic force. So they use like some sort of hypnotic force supposed to expel the witch. It didn't work. Like the strange phenomena continued on. And finally, Absalom Lawrence and his family moved to another town and it ended. So it is like, what was that? You know what I mean? Yeah. And even was the daughter just faking it all? I don't know. But you have those kind of different explanations for something over time. So I think if that happened now, you would call like an exorcist or a ghost hunter to come in. You wouldn't say it was a witch. You probably wouldn't call a hypnotist to come in and try to figure it out either.
Yeah. And it would make it it would make it even deeper if the phenomenon actually changes according to our collective consciousness as well. That's something I've considered be a possibility. I don't know. We've talked a little bit about female witches. We didn't get to any stories about warlocks. We have any good stories about warlocks you could tell?
Sure. Like one of the first witch stories from Massachusetts is from 1644. And this ship sailing from Boston back to Virginia, like it's a crew full of Virginia men, is sailing from Boston back south of Virginia, and it explodes in Boston Harbor. And someone on the ship had accidentally fired their pistol into the ship's gunpowder store, and the ship explodes. And, you know, people in Boston are able to find the bodies of most of the people who drowned, except for one person. They can't find this one man. They cannot find his body. And people start to say that the person who was missing was a necromancer or a, you know, a dark magician, right? He was doing evil magic. And there had been rumors about this guy when he was in Boston. They had said he had murdered someone back in Virginia. And not only was he a murderer, but he was also a necromancer, that he had sold his soul to the devil to learn evil magic. So his body cannot be found. Shortly after the search, they give up on the search. People in Boston at night see these glowing lights emerge from the water of the harbor. And the glowing lights form the shape of a giant man. And this shape of a man floats around above the harbor, and then people hear it speak. And it says, come away, boy, is what it says. And people see this thing for several different nights of these lights that emerge from the harbor, and they form the shape of a man, which is roaming around above the harbor, looking for something. And it's saying, boy, come away. And they believe that those lights were actually the devil. The devil had appeared above the harbor to try to find this dead necromancer to drag him off to hell. And the lights eventually disappeared, so they assumed that the devil got what he was after. And they never found the necromancer's body either. So that was 1644. So that's a pretty old one, I think. You know, and not every witch or wizard warlock was considered to be bad, like most were. Every now and then you find a few in these stories that are not particularly malevolent. Like there was one person who lived in Marblehead, Massachusetts, a man named Wizard Diamond. His name was Edward Diamond. And he had been a sailor and whatever, but he, when he was older, he practiced as a wizard. And he, during storms, he would climb to this big hill in Marblehead where there was a grave cemetery. He would stand in the cemetery when there was a storm, and ships that were out in sea trying to get into Marblehead would hear his voice, even though he was like 10 miles away. And from that vantage point in the cemetery on top of this hill, he would guide them through the storm safely into the harbor to get them out of harm's way, right? So people were like, oh, he's more or less a good person.
Right, right.
And he could also supposedly find stolen objects. There's a story where this poor widow came to him in the winter and was like, you know, somebody came and stole all my wood. They stole my firewood. It's cold. I'm probably going to freeze to death. And he's like, don't worry. I will use my magical powers to help you. And so he is able to figure out who the thief is. And then he somehow magically punishes this thief. So the thief is compelled to tie a huge tree stump to his back, like this massive log, and just walk up and down the main street of Marblehead with this giant, like 70-pound log tied to his back for hours and hours and hours, until finally this guy who stole the widow's firewood says, I give up, I'll return her firewood, I admit it was me, and I'll never do it again. And so there's like a more benevolent view, I think, of, you know.
Right. It doesn't seem like there is that many accounts of, you know, malevolent warlocks, you know, being in league or covens with witches, at least around that era, right?
Yeah, not as many. Again, it was women were targeted more, I think. You know, if you look at the Salem witch trials, the head of the alleged leader of the witches was this a minister named George Burroughs. And so he was accused of being a wizard. They actually called him a conjurer, right? He wasn't just a witch, he was a conjurer, meaning he was higher above everybody else. And so he, you know, people said, oh, the devil has promised he'll be the king of hell and all of this sort of stuff. And really what had happened with George Burroughs was that he had been the minister in Salem. The ruling sort of political family in Salem didn't like him, so they refused to pay his salary. And he worked there in Salem for 3 years with no salary. And he actually had to take a loan out from the ruling family, this family called the Putnams. He had to take a loan out from the Putnams to live because they refused to pay his salary. And finally, he's like, you know, I'm getting out of Salem. This place is terrible. He moved to Southern Maine, but the Putnam family sued him because they wanted the loan back they had given him. Like, we want your loan back. So he was brought to court. When he was at court, he's like, I can't pay back the loan because you owe me 3 years of salary. And the judge actually said, Putnam family, you must pay George Burroughs 3 years of salary that you owe him so he can repay the loan, which they did. They were pissed off. And then several years later, they accused George Burroughs of being a witch, and he is actually executed in great part just because he, you know, ran afoul of this Putnam family, who was sort of the most powerful family in Salem Village at that time.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately, that's the way it goes. I want to hear about the Melonheads of Connecticut. What are these?
Yeah. The Melonheads are supposedly these little humanoids. I guess I've talked about little humanoids a few times now, but whatever. Little humanoids. They have small spindly bodies, really big oversized heads, and supposedly large, often orange eyes. And they're found mostly in Fairfield County, Connecticut. And they're found on certain roads that go through the woods. This is what people say. I've never seen one myself. This is the legend.
Right.
And so these roads kind of go through dark areas with no lights, you know, through the woods and things like that. These are often places where teenagers will go at night to try to like see a melon head, right? Or capture a melon head or whatever. Like, it's kind of your spooky trip you're going to take with your friends after.
Right.
Whatever. Don't drink and drive. And there is a story about like five girls in the 80s who get in their car. I don't remember the type of car. It's like a big sedan that you would have in the 80s. And they go into one of these roads. They're like, they want to find a melon head. They just want to get scared and see one of these little creatures. So they drive the big car. They go and they park. And they all get out of the car. And they're wandering around the road, like looking for the melon heads. They have flashlights. They're looking, looking. And suddenly they hear the car engine start behind them. And the car headlights come on. And they all look back at the car, and there behind the wheel is this little spindly humanoid with a big head and these big orange eyes holding the steering wheel, and the car starts to drive right at them. And the girls just like dive off the road, and the car barrels off. And people say supposedly that car can still be seen sometimes like driving through the Connecticut woods at night with like at least one melon head, if not multiple melon heads, like behind the wheel, like just driving like little maniacs down the road and things like that. And that's sort of the humorous side of the legend.
Yeah.
The other side is like, you know, if hikers go missing or pets go missing, people are like, you know, maybe it was a coyote, maybe it was a melon head that got your cat or your dog or something like this. And there are a couple different stories of what melon heads supposedly are. In one story, it goes back to the Puritans again, like they were a family that's accused of being witches. They're not witches, but they are kicked out of the village where they live. And so this small family moves into the woods and they live on their own, and they actually inbreed with each other. And slowly over time, due to the inbreeding and they only eat like wild animals or whatever, they slowly kind of devolve into these little melon head creatures. Wow. So they've been there for like, you know, 350 years, slowly becoming these little monstrous creatures. That's one story. And another story, they are also like the descendants of people who escaped from an insane asylum, which I don't know how they become melon heads from that, but that's another story.
Yeah, that sounds terrifying.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
One interesting thing is that they're found in Connecticut. The legend is found in Connecticut. They're also found in parts of the Midwest, like around Michigan and Ohio. So those are the only two parts of the country. I don't know like how that happened, like, because they're pretty widely separated. So did someone from Connecticut move out to the Midwest? Did someone from the Midwest move to Connecticut? Did they just have family? Like, how does that story spread? You know, and the stories from the Midwest leave out the Puritan part, because that doesn't make sense out there. They talk more about a doctor, a mad doctor named Dr. Crow, who would experiment on children with like radiation and chemicals and things like that. And the melon heads are those children or the descendants of those children. And they kill the doctor and then just escape into the woods, and they still live out in the woods, you know.
Wow, that's creepy. Either way, I wouldn't want to come across a melon head. Or
look forward to seeing, really.
Yeah, or a Goatman, for that matter. Tell us a little bit about the Goatman legends from that area.
Sure. Yeah, there. You know, like Goatman legends are found all over the country, right? There are lots of Goatman legends. They've only found really three from this part of the country. It's not as common as it is in like Texas or some other places. There's a lot of Goatman stuff. But the one that I really like, I've only seen it in one book, but it's a good story. From Cherryfield, Maine, a small town in Maine, we've come to a story about a goat man. And the story goes something like this, where, you know, a guy from Cherryfield is out driving down a road through the woods in his pickup truck. He's listening to the radio, driving down the road in his pickup truck. And suddenly the engine dies all of a sudden, and the radio stops as well. Like the truck is completely shut down. The engine, the electricity, everything is shut down. Guy's like, damn, what happened? Gets out of the truck, opens up the hood, is looking at the engine, it looks fine. And he hears these footsteps coming out of the woods. So he turns to see what's happening. And he sees coming out of the woods, this guy, another man, who's wearing like a red flannel shirt. But he notices the man in the red flannel shirt coming out of the woods is naked from the waist down and has goat legs and goat hooves. And he also has goat horns. And as this goat man walks across the road, he just kind of smiles at the guy who's fixing his truck. He's like, gives him a creepy goat man smile and keeps walking back onto the other side of the road into the woods. And the guy at the truck is like, what happened? And as soon as the goat man disappears into the trees, the truck engine starts up again. The radio comes back on. Like all the systems are go again. And the man gets back in his truck and just drives back into town. And I think I like that one because it's creepy.
It is.
I like the sort of electrical system not working, right? Which you often see, we're talking about phenomena. Like you often see that with UFO stories. But yeah. In this, you see it with like a goat man. And then that red plaid shirt, of course, makes sense in Maine because it's cold. You're not going to run around with your shirt off. But also, like, there's a hitchhiking ghost kind of in southern Massachusetts on, I think it's Route 44. He wears a shirt like that. Like, you see a red plaid shirt shows up, I think, in certain other paranormal stories, too. You know what I mean? People have seen Bigfoot wearing red plaid shirts. Weird, but hey, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, since you – go ahead.
I was going to say, that's one Goatman story. The other one I know really well is from Cape Cod, from the 1970s. And it's like December, I think it's like December 1978. And this teenage boy is at home. His parents have gone out to run some errands. So this teenage boy is home alone. And he's watching TV. And the TV is like on the opposite side of the room from him. And there's a window right above the TV. So he's sitting there, it's like a winter day, there's snow on the ground, he's just watching whatever, maybe he's watching a bad horror movie or cartoons, whatever. He's watching TV and his eyes drift up to the window above the TV and he sees this hairy face looking in the window, like a hairy human-ish face, right? And the teenage boy screams, ah! And then the thing looking in the window screams, ah! And it runs, it disappears. So this teenage boy is scared. This is before cell phones. So he doesn't know where, he can't reach his parents. So he calls all his friends who are home. He's like, did you prank me? Did you put on a werewolf mask or an ape mask and be in my backyard? His friend's like, no, we're all home. So some of his friends come over, they ride their bikes over to his house. They're like, okay, let's go out in the backyard and see what we can see. They all go out in the backyard and underneath the window, and leading out into the woods, they can see these footprints. But they're not like a Bigfoot footprint. They're cloven hooves. And you see the cloven hoof footprint going off into the woods. And I like that one too, because it's the cloven hoof part creeps me out. Like,
yeah, it is creepy. Definitely. Well, you mentioned Bigfoot a couple of times tonight, and I'm wondering if you have any Bigfoot stories or any other strange cryptids, dogmen, stuff of that nature.
Oh boy, I'm trying to think of a good story because I have a lot of them. And now, let's see, dogmen. Not so much dogmen.
Or any cryptid or strange creature, you know, other than the ones we've discussed.
You know, certainly you would see a lot like, there are some Bigfoot stories from around here. Like Leominster, Massachusetts, there's an area there called Monsterland. It's like a, there's like a railroad bridge and woods and hiking and nature preserve area. And so Monsterland has monster, of course, assorted monster legends associated with it. Like there's one which is pretty legendary. It is like a legend, but I like it, where there's a bar nearby the area where these monsters supposedly live. And again, it's probably like the 1970s. A guy pulls up to the bar in his car and he's like, "You won't believe what I saw. I was in the woods and I saw this large hairy monster, like this large hairy humanoid. And I want you to all come with me. We're gonna go find it." The people in the bar are like, "Ah, you're crazy. There's no monster out in those woods. We're not gonna go with you." The guy's like, "All right, I'm going back. I'm gonna capture it. I'm gonna get a photo, whatever." So he gets in his car. He drives to the area where the monster is supposed to be, parks his car by the side of the road and goes into the woods. And then the next day, people driving down that road see the car is still there. And the next day again, people see the car is still there. So they call the police and they never find the man. Like his car was abandoned. Did he just not come back to it? Like they never ever found the man again, but his car was there. And eventually just towed to the junkyard. But people more recently say in that part of Leominster, Massachusetts, you can see people have found footprints in the mud and things like that, like Bigfoot footprints. So there is definitely like a Bigfoot vibe there. And there's a book just called Monsterland. I can't remember the name of the guy. His first name is Ronnie. I can't remember. He's been on some paranormal shows too. But yeah, Monsterland in Leominster is a place. Out in... Further west, there's a place called Cobble Mountain, out in the Berkshire Mountains, where there's also been Bigfoot sightings, like something throwing rocks. It, you know, when people are camping,
right?
You just hear the noises in the woods and things like that. So then you do hear those stories, and I wonder, like, what it is, right? Because the forests here are not old growth virgin forests. Like most of the forests here are new growth. Like everything here was cut down was farmland for a couple hundred years. Then people abandoned the farms for various reasons and all the forests came back. So it wasn't like there's always been like this virgin forest for a big hairy monster to hide out in. You know, so I wonder what, I don't know, I do wonder what people see or what they're experiencing out there.
Yeah, that's one of those things that I've become more interested in lately after I moved to a more wilderness area in the mountains in Colorado. But yeah, there's a lot of sightings in this area too, and it makes me wonder what the hell that is as well.
Go ahead. I count myself lucky I haven't seen anything like that yet.
Yeah, me either. Now, I thought we could close on maybe giving some people, if they're interested in finding some of those creepy locations in around that area, maybe you could give them some suggestions for the some of the best, your favorites.
Sure. Yeah, there are a bunch of them. This is kind of like a weekend thing, right? Like I do, and we go out and we find a graveyard or whatever. I've been to like the Ramtail Mill, which is down in Foster, Rhode Island. This is an old colonial era mill from, 1700s, which when it was built was like this prosperous mill factory type of place. It was powered by the river. They were making cloth and things there. And the manager of the mill was a guy named Peleg Walker. Peleg Walker was his name. He managed the mill. He didn't own it. Like the mill was owned by another person. Peleg Walker was supposedly like in love with the mill owner's daughter. He was like, "Yeah, I want to marry your daughter. I'm the manager, I do a good job, and I feel like I want to marry your daughter." And the owner of the mill is like, "Yeah, no, like you work for me, I'm rich, you're not gonna marry my daughter. That's not gonna happen." And so the next, Peleg Walker is, really upset and he rushes off out of the owner's office. The next morning, people hear the bell in the mill ringing, and that's what summons all the people to work. You hear the bell and it's time to go to work. So they hear the bell ringing. They go to the mill to start working. But then when they go into the mill building, they see that Peleg Walker is hanging by his neck from the bell rope. And that's why the bell is ringing, because his body is like swinging back and forth, ringing the bell. And he's committed suicide because he was so upset. The owner of the mill like cuts his body down, cuts down Peleg Walker's body and says, everybody just ignore this, like just go back to work. And so they work that day. The next morning, again, the bell rings. And so all the people, all the workers come to the mill and they see that the bell is ringing when they go inside, but nobody's ringing it. Like the rope is just swinging on its own back and forth and the bell is ringing, ding, 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 ding. The owner's like, you know, I get it's probably just the breeze, whatever. Like he removes the rope from the bell entirely. So then the next morning, again, people hear the bell ring, they go, like, how is the bell ringing? There's no rope. Like, it's just ringing on its own. And finally the owner takes the bell down. He's like, I'm taking down the damn bell. Like, we're taking down the bell. And the next morning again, people hear the bell ringing. And that's when people finally realize that the place is haunted and cursed. And so after that, people will see Peleg Walker's ghost like in the building at night carrying a lantern as he's patrolling around. You'll see him walking around the mill building. And so everybody quits. Like people say, we can't work here. Like this place is cursed, this is haunted, we can't do it. The workers leave, the mill shuts down. And now if you go to the Ramtail Mill area, which is in the woods in Foster, Rhode Island, you find the ruins of the mill and the ruins of the village where the people live. And it's quite big, like big cellar holes, a road, walls, all of this stuff. And we went there in the middle of the day. Like I only go to spooky places during the day. We went during the day and it's one of the few times anything really strange has happened to me when I visited these places, where I took some photos and I had an iPhone. Like I'm taking photos with my iPhone. And a lot of the photos came out just pure white, like nothing, like, and then when I took photos after we left, everything was fine. So how does that happen? I was like, this is creepy. And I was creeped out when I was there too, because we were there, there was nobody else there in this empty, abandoned ghost village, you know, where something terrible happened. So it's an interesting place to go. It is creepy, I will say. It is quite creepy.
That's awesome. Now, if people would like to find out more about you and get some of your books, what's the best way for them to do so?
They can check out my blog. My blog is newenglandfolklore.blogspot.com. So again, newenglandfolklore.blogspot.com. Also, if you just look up New England Folklore Blog, I'm pretty much the one that will come up. You can get my book, Witches and Warlocks of Massachusetts, pretty much wherever you buy books. So that's Amazon, Books a Million, Barnes and Noble, bookshop.org, places like that, you can get it also.
Sweet. And I will have a link to your website in our description for people to go check it out as they're listening to this. Peter, thank you so much for coming on. That was awesome stuff. And there's so much more we could talk about. I'd love to have you back on in the future.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'd love to come back on. This is a lot of fun.
Thank you, everyone, for listening again. And we will be back yet again tomorrow with a new episode. So have an excellent evening. We'll talk again tomorrow.